Hello and welcome to Into the Wild. I'm eating a blackberry. Welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast about animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. I saw a blackberry on that blackberry bush and I wanted to eat it. It looks so sweet. You know the ones you see that are perfectly round? I was like, that's the one I want. So I started eating it and then I decided to start talking. So unprofessional. I don't care. That's what we're going with. That's the start of the show. Hello and welcome. Usually when I record these, I'm actually sat in my room in Archway in North London. I've got the window closed, the curtains drawn across to make sure there's no outside noise coming in. But today I'm somewhere completely different. I'm here in Greenford in West London, in specifically Hornsdon Hill Park, somewhere that used to be many acres of grazing land for livestock, but now has been transformed back into the long grass and wildflower meadow that was probably here many, many years before. It's absolutely stunning. The grass is nearly about 2 foot high in some places. You've got so many different colours of wildflower. The wildlife is unreal. You can hear all the crickets probably on the recorder now. You've got butterflies, bees, wasps, many birds. The swifts are actually coming down in the middle of the field in the midday sun to feed on all the different insects. It's a true haven for wildlife. So I thought, why not record the intro here, somewhere where I love to visit. I'm also here to ask you a bit of a favour. Now I know, oh my God, another favour, what do you want? We've done so many episodes throughout lockdown and the global pandemic, and I've had many people get in touch with me and say, thank you for bringing us something that we need, some wild, nature-y chat in a time when we weren't allowed to go outside, and it was a big help. And that means the absolute world to me that the episodes we've recorded have helped people, not just in the UK, but around the world. That's a truly lovely thing for me to know. Something I'd absolutely love to ask all of my listeners. If you listen on iTunes, please log on and leave us a review. It helps so much. It helps push our podcast higher up the charts and gets more people to see and hear about our show. If you don't listen on iTunes, that's fine. We're on Spotify, we're on Podbean. You can leave us a comment. You can share it on Instagram and Twitter. Tag us in at Into the Wild Pod. Just talking about us and telling the world that we exist can get more and more listeners and therefore more and more episodes. The other thing to remind you all is that I'm a one-man band. I record them all myself, I edit them, I put them out there. Apart from my guests, it is literally just me. Now, I could chat about animals every day of the week, 24/7, but I want to know what you guys want to hear about. If there's something in the nature industry or the wildlife world that you want to know about, your favourite animal, some conservation, or even a person that you want to hear from, get in touch and let me know. MrRyanJDalton@gmail.com. That's my email address. Give me a shout. Anything you want to hear about, you tell me. I'd love to know because, like I said, I love planning episodes, but I want to make sure you lot are getting the information that you truly want. Now, before I move on to today's show, I'm just going to walk into the middle of the field here. If I'm going to go a bit deeper in here, and I want you to just listen to the noises that I can hear, because I absolutely love crickets. It takes me back to when I was a kid. I used to go to a field near my grandparents' house and used to try and catch all the crickets and grasshoppers. So I'm going to put the microphone down here, and I just want you to listen to all these noises. Check it out. It's easy to forget about animals that live around you, and it's especially easy to forget about the ones that once called your country home but are there no more. This week I spoke to zoologist and science communicator Sophie Pavel. Sophie has already had an amazing career working closely as an ambassador for the Wildlife Trust and Beaver Trust, and is currently writing her first book, Forget Me Not, about UK vulnerable species. We focused our chat on beavers, how these animals can completely change an environment and a landscape in just a couple of days' work, and what's being done to get these animals back into the UK ecosystem. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Sophie, welcome to Into the Wild, and thank you so much for joining me on today's show. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. I'm very honoured to be on the show, actually. I'm a bit of a fan, I have to say.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say.
Yeah. And I'm not just saying it, I promise. I could, someone could be paying me to say it, but they're not. So.
Yeah, for the listeners, just to let you know, I've not paid anything for that. That was from the heart. That was
disclaimer. Yeah, totally from the heart. No, it's very good. I have been enjoying it, and it's been somewhat of a sort of podcast-filled few weeks. I feel like there's been a lot of good ear food going around during lockdown and things.
There has. I just said to you a minute ago, it's that perfect time of people are free and around over the last 3 or 4 months. So it's been a good time to get some people, pin them down for half an hour and get some good information out of them kind of thing.
go.
So thanks so much for being on the show. I'm super excited to talk to you. Before
Pleasure.
We get going with our questions and stuff, let's get the listeners clued up on who you are. Can you tell us who you are and what you do?
So I am a zoologist. This is what it says on my bio anyway. Apparently I'm a zoologist and science communicator. So I did zoology at uni and then did a master's in science communication. Mm. And broadly, I spend a very happy, quite busy at the moment time, trying to get more people out there loving nature, being interested, asking good questions, and trying to make nature, especially British wildlife and landscapes, a exciting thing and something that we need to take care of and something that we need to have fun in, but also be mindful of its future. So I do a lot of work with different charities, for NGOs. I work for Beaver Trust. I do try to find out funky stories in the natural world and turn them into stuff that perhaps people who don't necessarily think they like nature might understand and might enjoy. So, yeah.
That's really cool. That's a really nice job to do, like, if you love nature, to try and get people into nature, surely.
Yes, totally. No, I feel very lucky, actually, to because it's not only really fun to try and sort of relay your enthusiasm, but I learn so much all the time because to try and sort of, you know, find out a new piece of information or a new bit of science, or for example, in the news, there's been so much in the news recently about especially the potential for rewilding Britain in some ways and restoring landscapes. So in order to translate that into, you know, your average piece of information that your average kind of 23-25-year-old can understand, you have to learn so much about it yourself in the process. So it's just a really enjoyable process, and it's a very exciting time indeed to be in this sort of space, and there's a lot of change. It's incredibly dynamic. It's quite political as well.
Yes.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff keeping me out of mischief. So, and there's just incredible people working as well in this space. So in terms of the people I get to work with and the people I meet, it's just so inspiring to be kind of just a very, very small part of what's going on at the moment.
And I guess, like you said, it's changed massively, and not just like kind of the industry, but also just nature itself has changed massively over the years. And when, for you, being that lover of wildlife and nature, and probably specifically British wildlife as well, because it's something you've grown up with, how and like when did your love for nature and wildlife begin for you?
There's not a, I would love to have a very specific sort of anecdote, but I think it's just been something that has always sort of been there. I mean, my parents were both in the military, so we've grown up sort of moving about a little bit, but then very much with an outdoorsy, adventurous focus. So we've just spent so much time outside, in nature, around nature. One of my earliest memories is just very classic, I think, is just lining up all my beanie babies and pretending they're all sick and making all the animals better and all that sort of stuff.
That's adorable. Sorry, that is the best starter of this like podcast I think we've ever had.
and then I became obsessed with the idea of getting guinea pigs, so much so that I actually invented an invisible hamster called Honey. I made her a playpen, I made her like a water bottle, I made her a slide, and I was so serious about the fact that Honey was real, Honey was a breathing, living mammal that needed care, that every day before school, I sat my parents down, I was like, guys, you haven't fed honey yet, and I'm going to school now, so you guys, I need to be confident that you guys are going to look after my hamster so that when I get home, she's fine.
Yeah.
And then I think they were like, wow, this child is crazy.
What Let's a difficult job for your parents.
I know, they were just shutting me up by getting me a couple of guinea pigs, and then that was that, so.
Because you could just make anything up at the end of the day. They could be like, well, we pretended to do that, and you'd be like, where is she?
I know. Looking back, I think there might have been some slightly deeper issues.
don't dig. So you've done a lot of work with the Wildlife Trust as well. You're an ambassador for the Wildlife Trust since 2017. Yes. After you completed a 300-mile science communication exhibition, can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, that was a very silly thing, really, wasn't it? So that was been working with the Wildlife Trust for a long time, just as sort of like mainly in just a voluntary advocacy role, really, which I love doing, and I just get to be involved in lots of their campaigns and their sort of broader thinking and things like, and their comms and things just on the side. So I came across them when I was doing my master's project, and my project dissertation was, I wanted to do something a little bit different because I did a very labby, sort of very traditional sciencey project in zoology for my third year. So I wanted to do something that was a bit more me, a bit more creative, and gave me an excuse to be outside for 3 weeks during one of the hottest Junes on record. So I'm quite a master manipulator, I'm realising.
Hey, you're doing what you love, so don't judge it.
Seems to be a trend here, doesn't it? my research question was, how can social media and digital platforms be used as a science communication tool for British conservation and wildlife? Mm. So essentially, I love sort of hiking and expedition and mountain sort of stuff, and so I thought, well, why don't I go on a 3-week expedition and play around with social media as I go and try and sort of communicate nature and the wildlife that I come across and see how people react to it when I put it online, and then came up with all sorts of data and interviewed charities, including the Wildlife Trust and Surface Against Sewage, and interviewed them about how they use social media to communicate their messaging and their campaign strategy and stuff. And I just think it was a bit of a whirlwind, really. And I think it was a real stroke of luck with timing, because at that time, so we're talking, 2017, that was when Instagram, Facebook and Twitter were on the very cusp of becoming the, you know, especially Instagram, the sort of total social media kings that they are in terms of public information system and a way for people to understand, especially nature. I don't think nature had really exploded on social media in the way that it has now. Yeah. So it was very much in this kind of experimental phase. It was really exciting to try and sort of get little hints as to, you know, people actually do love seeing nature on social media, and they don't care that it was filmed, you know, in a very very low production value on a smartphone. Yeah. They just the great thing about social media is that if you're enthusiastic about it and you're really positive, you know, engagement thrives on positivity and also I think individualism. So if you're personally really excited about a 6-spot burnet moth on a bit of grass, you know, if you just let yourself kind of yourself on social media, then you're going to inspire someone. So
that's incredibly true. I could not agree with you more on that. I mean, the other day I tweeted that I found a purple emperor, well, my girlfriend found a purple emperor butterfly, and I was like, should I tweet this? So I tweeted it, and the engagement, I was just like, this is so exciting, and people were like, yeah, that's amazing.
wow, that is amazing.
It was a female, which is amazing, but also we were like, well, now we've got to find a male. They've got to be around here.
You're nice. You're not as good.
Yeah, we just need that purple. It was still. I had that moment, especially from my comedian Twitter account. I'm like, should I post this here? Are people going to care about this? But then I thought, well, no, you care. So
yeah, exactly. Don't overthink it.
Yeah, just don't overthink. Just do it, and it's great. What kind of areas of interest did you notice that people love to engage with the most with nature? Was it more of a visual side, or did you find that videos over photos, or did it really matter, or is it just the conversation?
Good question. I think mainly it was visual stuff, and I think also with the video stuff, that was most popular when it was giving an insight into the actual adventure narrative. So how was I doing? How far did I have to walk that day? Was the weather really hot? Was I struggling? Was I doing really well? Did I just do like an insane climb, or did I fall over, which I fell over a lot? in terms of nature stuff, I think... that was also really before Instagram stories kicked off.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a really interesting experiment to see what it's like now. I would not envy whoever would do the analytics and the quantitative crunching from that, because it's just mad the sort of data you can get from it all now. But I think it was the visual stuff worked really well, and mainly again just the opportunity to have the freedom to put your voice behind stuff.
Yes, yeah, that's very true with the Insta stories. I find that it's very personal to you, and it means that anyone can be a presenter for that little bit. You can actually talk to people, talk to the world, and that's really cool. We promised each other a chat about beavers. Do you remember that?
Please let me talk about beavers.
Yeah. When I sent my emails and you were like, I can chat anything from beavers and beyond, I was like, well, there's our episode title. So
beavers.
Let's chat about beavers and beyond. So my first question, and I know why I do, but why do you love beavers?
Well, I mean, how long have we got? beavers are just the most unique mammal ever. There is no other, to my knowledge, mammal that offers so much to an environment that benefits not only countless other species, from plants to birds, to other mammals, even like otters, but also to us.
Yeah.
And that directly benefits our lifestyle and the way that we use the land. And also the fact that it's just got an incredible skill set that that totally transforms an environment from, say, a sort of very bland, boring, monoculture-y kind of single stream with a couple trees dotted about, into this absolute like Eden of a wetland with oak trees, with damselflies, dragonflies, with trout, with salmon, with water voles, otters, kingfishers, spotted flycatchers. It's just an incredible thing, and I can't also think of an animal where you can see its evidence so clearly, and its evidence is so diagnostic. So all of their kind of their classic pencil-shaped stumps along the riverbank and their beaver chips on the side, and you can it's an amazing thing when you see lots of different parts of the puzzle, and then when you see the animal itself, if you're lucky enough to, it just all makes sense. And when you're at school and you're learning biology, I went to a science specialist school, and it was a great school. However, it was just, we learnt nothing about ecology. Mm. And I'm only realising the importance of, the stark gap that leaves now. And I remember learning, about plant cells and about mitosis and meiosis. And it's just like, okay, this is all fine, but like, I don't understand how it's applicable to like real life. But when you see... And you learn about evolution, you learn about how an animal's adapted to its environment, but there are very few cases, especially in Britain, where we can actually see an animal and be like, yeah, got it, okay, that's why it's got iron in its teeth, that's why it's got four paws like that, that's why its fur's waterproof, that's why it's got triangular nostrils, that's why its ears are on top of its head, all because when you see it when it's in its environment, everything makes sense. You can say, right, okay, it's got that because it does that. It's got that because it does that, and I can see that, and I can touch the stumps, and I can appreciate the incredible strength that this animal has, and the ability that it has to transform the river.
It is amazing when you see, because I've only obviously had the privilege of just watching it on recorded footage, of seeing what beavers do, and the amount of work that they do is just...
Oh, they're grafters.
Yeah, they're just non-stop, and you're just like... And like you said, the environment goes from this, could be very, you know, just boggy mud pile with just, you know, very heavy green and not many flower and not much, and to suddenly turn into this incredible, colourful, rich environment,
yeah,
just from
totally.
One animal is just like, yeah, that's outstanding, really.
It is. It really is. It's very special, and it gives you an idea about the importance of structure in an ecosystem and the different levels of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very visible to see. It's just amazing.
So let's get down to a bit of the basics of beavers. So where can we find them? Where do they live?
So beavers live in what's called riparian habitat. So riparian is basically rivers and the catchment, so the area surrounding rivers.
Mm.
They like sort of fairly deep rivers because then it gives them room to swim around and travel and things, but they can very easily sort of walk around and in between the shallow sandbanks and things, so
yeah,
they're not really that fussy. They can transform a river very quickly. They just need to, what's really important is the rivers that they are on. It's really good if they've got a little bit of a buffer,
yeah,
so a margin between the riverbank and say either a footpath or a bit of farmland, because when they start to build the dams and the water starts to collect in the beaver ponds, if it spills over during a period of rainfall or just through high tide, if it's a part of a tidal river, which the lower reaches of the River Otter, where the beavers are in Devon near me, that's a tidal river,
yeah,
towards the mouth of the sea, mouth of the river near the sea, they will if they don't have that buffer, they will start to flood farmland, flood the path, and that's where beavers can be, can cause conflict. So,
yes, yeah,
bit of woodland, bit of scrub, nice bit of water, but then really importantly, they need a buffer.
Yes. Okay. Cool. And I've never studied, I've never worked with them, so I really know nothing about them. But what do they eat? What kind of? Am I silly to ask? Do they eat wood? That's a silly
question. You're not silly at all. No. So they are 100% vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
So they only eat plants. They eat everything from, properly eat it and digest it, as well as using it for building material. Oak, willow, aspen, cherry, apple. They like hazel as well. They feed on all sorts of scrubby bits. They actually can just graze on grass as well.
Oh, cool.
So just a fully very trendy plant-based diet.
They're very 2020. You said about that buffer as well. Is that when you say a buffer, is that like an overflow system, do you mean, that they kind of need?
Just like a natural area of scrubby patch and stuff to give them enough space to kind of get up onto the bank, move around, do a bit of feeding.
Cool.
move stuff. If they fell a tree, it will just give that space to happen too.
And is this part of the battles that we're seeing with less space? Because whenever we talk about beavers, I feel like whenever we hear about them in media, especially, we're always hearing about the battle that they face about getting them back into areas of the UK. You know, we want them back here because they can improve this area, but we know it's going to... landowners don't want them in certain areas. Is that the kind of reason why we're seeing that battle, is because they can change an ecosystem, but obviously that can come at some consequence as well?
Yeah, completely. So beavers were around until 400 years ago. Unfortunately, habitat loss and then hunting them forced them to become extinct. And since that time, so in the last 400 years, the landscape has changed unrecognisably from when beavers were last here.
Yeah.
So we have basically moved on, we've mechanised, we've grown massively in population in a world without beavers. So naturally, any disturbance that they do seems alien and seems invasive, because we're just not used to how they use the land, because we weren't there when they were here before.
Mm.
And you know, beavers naturally are a bit of a pain in the arse. They do cause all the good work that they do. We like to sort of personify it and sort of say, oh, it's lovely, isn't it lovely and altruistic. It's not. Beavers don't think about what they're doing. They just have an innate drive and genetic structure which tells them to fell a tree and tells them to do that, and the byproduct is all very nice, but the other byproduct is that they create a bit of a mess.
Yes.
And on an island that's very small, 75% of land is used for agriculture, and we have an enormous growing population that's being slowly squeezed into smaller and smaller spaces. having the second largest rodent in the world, sort of digging things up and felling trees, is naturally a cause for discussion. Shall we say.
that's the politest way you could have put that, and I'm.
So yeah, you know, there's all sorts of stakeholders involved. There's but the people whose voices we value the most are the people who work the land, and also the people who have the power to make the ultimate decisions. So, you know, and it's charities like Beaver Trust and the Wildlife Trust and the RSPB who are working really hard at the moment, because the DEFRA, the government, are going to make their decision around September time as to whether they're going to let beavers stay and legally recognise them as a native mammal, and then start to bring them back properly and to create a big management programme as to how we can live with beavers once again. So it's all about recognising and hearing the voices of the different people involved and working out a way that we can coexist well and come up with all sorts of mitigating plans as to, you know, as climate change starts to take hold and we have more extreme weather. Beavers are an amazing ally, and we need to recognise them as that, but we do need to have the systems in place so that they have space to do what they need to do, and that farmers and people who work the land day after day also have the space to do what they need to do.
And as you said, it's vitally important to recognise that they've not been here for 400 years, and it's not as easy as just going, click your fingers, they're back, let it happen. A lot has changed. And in order to do it, we have to do it the right way, I guess. What can people... Because did you say September that's being made, that decision?
Yes, yeah. So we find out in September as to what their decision's going to be. But, I mean, we were meant to find out in March, but it's been pushed back.
Yes.
And so don't know for sure whether it could be pushed back again. We just don't know.
Is there anything people can be, you know, from people listening now and people out there on Twitter and Instagram and stuff, is there anything people can be doing to help or the Beaver Trust or just beavers in general? Is there something people can be doing?
Yeah, totally. So Beaver Trust is a really new charity, so we're still very much in the process of getting lots of things set up, like subscriptions and things like that. But we do take donations, and at the moment the donations will go towards helping to come up with a very good coherent management framework strategy, so that if, you know, whatever the decision is in September, we can continue to try and work to still bring beavers back. Yes, you can donate through Beaver Trust website. You can, the Wildlife Trust have a petition on their website as well, and you can sign it to basically rally support for their beaver strategy and help lobby the government. So essentially, the more positive communications that we have surrounding the beaver, public support is a huge friend when the government's making a decision. So basically, keep learning, keep reading, keep sharing. But the more positive we are about bringing the beavers back, the more likely we are to see them back.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. The other thing I'd like to discuss is you have a book coming out in a couple of years, in 2022, called Forget Me Not, which is also the name of my favourite wildflower, so totally impressed with that.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely love it. I don't know, I just love the colour of it, and it's very, very pretty.
It's very pretty.
And the book is about finding, like, kind of finding the vulnerable species within the UK or in the area you are. Which is something I assume you love to do, look for vulnerable species or find that. Have you got any success stories, or have you got a favourite that you found in the UK?
That is a good question. So I've only just started doing the travelling for the book at the moment.
Oh, cool.
Good old pal Corona has made that
really helped out there, buddy, thanks.
I did have an amazing experience with an ant last year with a project I was filming on called Back from the Brink, which isn't anything to do with my book, but in terms of a rare species, and it was called the narrow-headed ant.
Ooh.
And it's the rarest ant in England, and it is another one of those species where it's been totally overlooked, but actually without it, areas of amazing heathland would find it really difficult to survive, because like loads of invertebrates, they are the sort of key to the all their the sort of all the links in the chain in terms of the food web, and it's just this incredible animal that has an amazing symbiotic relationship with aphids. And and it is on a heathland right next to the motorway, 15 minutes from my house, and I've lived here for nearly all my life, and I had no idea that we had the rarest ant in England on my doorstep, so that was incredible.
That's always the way. That is always the way. Whenever you hear about people spotting, you know, a snow leopard, it was in the last 5 minutes of their trip, or when they're nearly back at camp, or, you know, like the ants, or even when we saw the bloomin' emperor butterfly, it was where we lead the dogs up every single day. Every single day. It was 10 foot away from where we stand 5 days a week. And I was like, why is it always like that? It's always, you never find it in where you go looking. It's always like, oh, it's by the bin.
I know. I set up a moth trap in lockdown in the hope of finding some moths, including my new favourite beetle, cockchafer. And I was just about to give up and go to bed. And then it ended up in my room. I was just like, hang on a sec. I thought I'd been a really good sciencey person and set up a proper trap and read articles about it and everything, and you just turned up in my room.
See, sometimes we just don't have to try, you know, you just ask the universe for it and it will deliver.
Yeah, exactly.
So on this, on our show, we often speak about the recent wave of environmental activism within, especially within the youth, that's happened in the last couple of years. Do you think this will, this kind of wave that we've seen over the last couple of years will have an impact on the way things work in this country in regards to protecting vulnerable species and even looking at things from beavers and pretty much everything? Do you think that wave is going to have an impact on the way, and I'll focus on the UK, but the way the UK runs and operates?
That's a really good question. I guess it depends what you mean by impact. If you mean, like, I think what the young people are really good at doing is not backing down and not being afraid to speak up when they've got a problem with something.
Yeah.
And I think that that is such an asset in a world where we've got the ability to raise our voice through digital platforms and things. And I think it's really important to have that confidence at such a young age and to actually realise, actually, yes, I do have a problem with that decision, and I do have a problem with, for example, HS2 going ahead.
Yeah.
And it is actually going to impact me because, you know, this is how I've been thinking is, you know, HS2, for example, and the current kind of decisions being made are going to seriously, personally impact a lot of people, whether it's financially, where they live, whether it's, you know, do they feel confident in the kind of niceness of the world to bring children up in it anymore.
Yes.
I think it's really empowering and inspiring to see when, especially recently, when decisions have been made and when people are like, actually, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to follow the way democracy works. I'm going to use my power as a voter, as a constituent, as a citizen, and actually write a letter, use my voice, use my words, and fight for what I believe is right. Whether that actually ends up making significant change, I don't know. But I think there is real power in people coming together and saying all the same thing. And it's really exciting that all those people who seem to be speaking up, all the Gen Z people, all of the Extinction Rebellion people, they are the future. So it makes me really excited to think about what the next generation of leaders and people are going to look like if, you know, when they were between 15 and, say, 25, they were speaking up for the environment and what they feel is right. I think it's a kind of sit back and watch sort of scenario.
It's like an impact that you can't measure at the moment.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do, but from what I'm seeing and from discussions with other people as well, it's a sort of exciting time and sort of like watching in the wings, like, ooh, what's this gonna be like?
this is good.
exactly. So
my last question, and this is something that I always ask everyone and something that I love hearing from my guests on the show is, if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone about the natural world, what would you pass on?
I think never sort of lose your own connection to it.
Yeah.
And I think never forget what drew you to, what captivated you about it in the first place.
Yeah.
It's a very noisy world at the moment, and it's quite a stressful, bruised world. And I think that we've all seen how powerful nature can be in helping to sort of save our heads a little bit during this difficult time. But I also feel like, it, you know, the science communication industry, for example, is mm-hmm. quite volatile too. It's quite competitive. There's a lot of people who want to be in the space. And sometimes it's very easy to lose sight of what drew you there in the first place. So I think I'm a big fan of, it takes me sometimes a bit too long to recognise when I've kind of gone down that spiral a little bit. So a big fan of kind of actually screens off, take some time out, go for a walk, be by yourself, go out, chill, and just spend a few days reconnecting with nature and kind of, yeah, rekindling that relationship, because we've all got it. It's just sometimes it comes in and out, and it's stronger some days than it is on other days, and that's totally fine. But I think never lose your personal connection to it.
Could not agree with you more, especially within the last few months. If you've lost it, go back out there and find it, because it's like you said, it's definitely there. It's in us all, so go out and find it.
Yeah, make time for it. Make time to do that.
Put it in your diaries, guys. God's sake, come on, you can do it. It's better than... Don't watch TV at 8 o'clock. Go for a summer evening walk.
Totally.
Thank you so much, Sophie, for joining me on today's episode. It's been
absolutely
lovely chatting to you. And good luck with your book. You said in the episode that you're just starting kind of that data and that research. So good luck with all of that. And I'll keep in touch.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you so much. Bye.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Sophie is working on, you can do so on Twitter at @spavel. You can also do that on Instagram at @sophiepavs. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. And you can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.